Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classic Gaming Brothers. I'm Seth.
And I'm Zach.
And we are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
We are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right.
That's right. That is right.
Great. How have things been?
I want to first, before we get started, thank Barry.
Yes, thank you, Barry. We appreciate you coming on to the show, and we appreciate Premium Edition and all the support that they give the show with their light.
Be sure to check out the episode and throw some support behind Premium Edition Games and their new stuff, their direct. So listen to our episode, and if you want to support them, go ahead.
Great. So anyway, Zach.
Yes, Seth.
What have you recently been playing?
Seth, recently I've been playing Little Sisyphus.
Like the guy who goes up the hill?
Exactly like the guy who goes up the hill. Developed by Pubby Games on itch.io, Little Sisyphus is a homebrew NES game developed in 2023 where you play as Sisyphus, as in the figure from Greek mythology who was destined to roll a boulder up a hill for all eternity because he was a tyrant, so he was being punished by the gods.
Yeah.
Now, just like in the myth, your task is to take a boulder up to different parts of a level, and you have to collect souls while you do it. The twist is that the boulder has a ton of momentum, and your little guy has to deal with that. So you can let go of the boulder, or you can hold on to it. When you hold on to it, it's tethered to you, so it's kind of on a short chain. And when it is tethered to you, your jumping is lessened. Also, your speed is lessened. However, you can use the boulder's momentum to either help you get higher into different parts of the level, or to give you a little bit of a speed boost. So it's a bit of a puzzle platform in that regard, as you're trying to kind of coordinate how exactly you're going to get to different parts of the level with this hindrance. It was developed as part of a game jam. The goal was to build an NES style game. It was an NES homebrew jam, and I think it is a pretty solid game. It definitely feels like a game built in a game jam. It has some quirks that take getting used to. However, I'm sure with more refinement, it could be a really fun homebrew, and I liked it. And also, it's free. So if you want to check it out, you can go to itch.io, look up Little Sisyphus, and you can play it for free right in your browser. It uses an emulator built into the browser, or you can download the ROM.
When I think about Sisyphus, I think about the game Zeus, where if you have a cart guy that he needs to go really far to get something, he complains that he feels like he's Sisyphus.
Oh, yeah.
Or it's like the guy who's at the Agora. He's like back and forth. But that's what I think of when I think of Sisyphus. It's not that he always has to push it up a never-ending hill. It's that it rolls down once he gets close to the top and he has to push
right,
it up
again. I don't think I said it was a never-ending hill, but he does have to
No, but
roll
just
it
in
forever.
Case anyone was confused, because we're the classical gaming brothers.
The classical gaming brothers. We're the mythological gaming brothers.
Yeah, we'll only talk about classical era video games. Games set in the classical era now. Anyway, I have not been playing. Actually, I'm going to immediately break my rule. I have not been playing a classical video game. I've been playing a game called Dredge. It's a single-player fishing adventure game, and it has a little bit of a scary undercurrent to it. It's a game where you crash your boat into like near a town, and you end up waking up in this town, and you get approached by the mayor of the town, and he lets you borrow a boat and to go out and fish, and then you bring the fish back and you sell it. But because they're letting you borrow this boat, you have to pay them off some debt. So every portion of your fish has to go to him. And they also say that you can fish during the day, but don't fish at night. Or if you do fish at night, be on the lookout for scary things. It's a pretty casual game. I enjoy it. I was going out and I was doing some fishing, and it was just fun playing the little fishing mini games. I actually was listening to a podcast at the same time, and it was just kind of enjoyable, just kind of sitting, relaxing, fishing and catching some fish while listening to a podcast. It's like if I was to actually go fishing, which Zach and I are actually accomplished fishermen, but
that's true.
And by accomplished meaning that we have accomplished fishing once. So it's kind of like that, except I don't have to possibly get wet nor watch Zach sink a boat.
Both things that have happened.
You kind of explore the area and discover kind of like why people kind of there's places that they don't explore for a reason. It's got a kind of a Lovecraftian vibe to it, which is always fun. I like that type of like undercurrent of like the Elder Ones and all that type of stuff. The game was originally released back in March of 2023, and it was developed by Black Salt Games and published by Team 17, and is a lot of fun. I think it's on sale right now for around 17 or 18 bucks. I definitely recommend picking it up if you're interested in that type of thing, and there's a bunch of DLC for it too. So that's Dredge.
Very cool. Well, today's episode, we're going to be talking about something a little differently, as we do. We're going to be talking about something topical.
Which is fun. I think this is great. I think this is one of the first times that we're going to talk about something that may actually get new listeners to our episodes. So, hi, welcome. If you've clicked this because you want to learn more about the Brotherhood of Steel, buckle up.
That's right. Back in episode 153, we talked about various Fallout factions and did a deep dive on their background, politics, and currencies. The factions we covered were the NCR, the New California Republic, the Legion, House, and the Three Families. If you want to hear us talk about those factions, head on back to episode 153. It's a great episode. I love it. Today, we're only going to talk about one faction because it's a doozy. That faction is the Brotherhood of Steel.
And a little context behind this episode, Zach was putting together the notes for the episode as he usually does, since I'm very bad at doing notes. And he was saying, like, hey, why don't we just do, like, let's talk about some Fallout factions and stuff, because there's plenty of stuff to unpack into Fallout. Like, we could do episodes on the various defaults, we could do episodes on more factions and, like, different kind of, like, pre-war stuff as well. And he was like, I'm gonna start writing about, like, the Enclave and stuff. And I was like, why don't we just talk about the Brotherhood of Steel? Because honestly, I think I started writing notes for this episode possibly a year ago, and I just got overwhelmed with the amount of stuff that there is to talk about with the Brotherhood of Steel. So that's kind of like the reason behind this episode and kind of like where we're going today. We kind of built this up similar to our 153 structure, where we're going to break down the Brotherhood of Steel as we broke down the other factions. In fact, they're such a large faction and important faction to the Fallout universe that you cannot have a Fallout game without having some representation of the Brotherhood of Steel. In fact, the Brotherhood of Steel are a faction that are in every Fallout game that has been released, including Fallout Tactics and the mobile game Shelter and the Brotherhood video game that we were just talking about earlier.
Yeah, off mic, we were talking about Fallout Brotherhood of Steel, which was an action game that's no longer canon.
But if you even consider all the non-canon or weird mobile games that come from the Fallout spinoffs, the Brotherhood of Steel are still in every Fallout game. Now, before we talk about the Brotherhood of Steel as a whole, we just want to briefly go over and cover the world of Fallout prior to the formation of the Brotherhood itself. From the year 2066 until 2077, the world was heavily engrossed in a conflict called the Sino-American War. This was between the United States of America, the U.S. annexed Canada, and the People's Republic of China. From 2074 until 2076, the U.S. and China reached a stalemate in conflict. During that time, research was being conducted by a company called Westech on the Pan-Immunity Virus, a preventative measure against the potential of Chinese-developed biological weapons. The United States Department of Defense was deeply concerned that Westech had been infiltrated by spies. So they sent in a team under the command of Colonel Robert Spindle and Captain Roger Maxson to oversee the project. Remember those names. The project would go on to be moved to Mariposa Military Base, and without the knowledge of the military personnel stationed at that base, testing began on human subjects. Now, in 2077, shortly before the advent of the Great War, the soldiers at Mariposa learned about the experiments. Colonel Spindle was horrified by what he learned and locked himself in his office, and Captain Maxson had to prevent an uprising of soldiers from killing the science team. Maxson was able to subdue any violence by ordering interrogations of the science team under his observation.
Now, Maxson interviewed a member of the science team who explained the U.S. government ordered human experimentation, but Maxson refused to believe him and killed the scientist. This action led Maxson to become the de facto leader of a growing rebellion of the military who were becoming aware of what the government was truly trying to do. Colonel Spindle, still being horrified by what he had learned, would end up taking his own life shortly after this. Now, Maxson would continue to interrogate and execute scientists until Aaron Shellman, one of the scientists, convinced him that the experiments truly were being ordered by the government. On October 20th, 2077, Maxson declared that his unit would secede from the United States. Now, this is a noble act from Maxson. Fortunately, 3 days later, nukes would fall and the Great War began, so there was no more United States.
Well, that's a story from another day.
With Maxson's action to secede from the Union and the dropping of the bombs, the Brotherhood of Steel was born. Now, the Brotherhood of Steel as a whole is a technological quasi-religious paramilitary order. After the Great War was finally over, Roger Maxon started the Brotherhood officially with the purpose of preserving and regulating advanced technology. Roger Maxon would become the first High Elder of the Brotherhood of Steel, and his son and grandson would end up inheriting the title after each of their deaths, with his grandson John Maxon being the current High Elder.
With Roger Maxon becoming like a High Elder and all of his sons and furthermore becoming High Elders as well, this begins the kind of hypocrisy that also bleeds into the Brotherhood of Steel, because they are very much a society of rules for thee or not rules for me. And
right, yeah.
We will go over some things where there are strictures and rules that the Brotherhood must follow, but there's always an addendum that says, except if a High Elder says to do otherwise. And most High Elders are related to Maxim.
Now, the Brotherhood of Steel would go on and expand across the wasteland, and in order to expand and maintain order, they created chapters. These chapters ultimately respect the authority of Lost Hills, the base of operations for the original Brotherhood of Steel chapter, and if they do not respect the authority or break from following the Codex, they become a rogue chapter.
And an important thing to note that these chapters are also very cell in organization within themselves, so they, as long as they respect Lost Hills, they're really allowed to organize themselves in any way they see fit. And we'll talk about the different hierarchies within the different kind of cells or the main cells of the Brotherhood of Steel, but it's important to know that Brotherhood of Steel is chapter organized but also kind of cellular organized in regards that their cells are self-contained within themselves. Now, the Codex, and that's a capital C Codex, was originally created by Roger Maxon, and it outlines the core tenets, doctrines, and responsibilities of the members of the Brotherhood. Once someone swears their oath of fraternity, then their name is added to the Codex as a brother. This part of the Codex is called the Scrolls, which each chapter maintains and communicates and synchronizes with Lost Hills, as the Scrolls not only detail whether or not a member is alive or dead, but also their achievements of each member of the society, which is scary and also a way that they probably use for politicking within the Brotherhood itself. Hence, a punishment in the Brotherhood is having one's name struck from the scrolls, and at that moment, all members of the Brotherhood will know you are no longer a member. And by at that moment, I mean once the Codex gets downloaded to the Lost Hills and the Lost Hills synchronizes with all the other Codexes, then they will know that you are no longer a member. It's not an immediate thing, so you could like interrupt it, but they would find out eventually. And with that ability to kind of have that punishment and have that kind of bite back, they're really able to keep their order. Even if they do split it across in the cells and into the chapters, they're able to kind of keep order in those chapters and make sure that they all still pay up essentially to the Lost Hills chapter, which is the primary chapter. In fact, they did. They split up into a number of different chapters. And in 2254, the Lost Hills Brotherhood decided that they needed to go to the Capital Wasteland, and they dispatched Paladin Owen Lyons and Scribe Reginald Rothschild, along with the Paladins Henry Kasdan, Ishmael Asher, and Tristan, with no last name.
Just Tristan.
Now, this group of five arrived and immediately beelined to the Pentagon, reclaiming the pre-war military base and discovering that the basement levels were mostly intact, including Liberty Prime, which is a giant robot. Liberty Prime is like if you took Iron Giant, gave him a bunch of lasers, and had him just shout patriotic things while he stormed around blasting people. That's pretty much Liberty Prime, in case anyone is wondering what Liberty Prime is. They find this mostly intact Liberty Prime, and it wasn't even activated. And it represented, at that moment, the most significant technological relic that the Brotherhood would be able to find. And that's part of, like, the Brotherhood's shtick, right? Finding technological relics, reclaiming them, and generally hating everybody else. And Paladin Lyons was then, with reporting into about Liberty Prime, was then directed by the Lost Hills chapter to establish a permanent base in the Capital Wasteland to continue to comb the area for any additional hidden technology. Now, after establishing the base in the Capital Wasteland, the newly promoted Star Paladin Lyons, instead of just Paladin Lyons, will go off and go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as Pittsburgh was plagued with all manner of raiders and mutants, and the Brotherhood of Steel was looking for technology and also looking for killing people. And so they would go on to purge the entire city of Pittsburgh.
Duke.
This is the time known as Scouring the Pit. And during this time, Ishmael Asher would be believed to have fallen. And Lyons breaks after Ishmael falls. And Lyons then begins to think less about recovering technology and the need to kill the people who killed Ishmael, who would be the mutants.
Now, it was in the Capital Wasteland that the Brotherhood of Steel also came into direct conflict with the Enclave. Now, the Enclave, for people who are familiar with Fallout, may share some visual similarities to the Brotherhood of Steel, especially considered they both really like to wear power armor, but they are ideologically and dogmatically very different. While both have anti-mutant beliefs, the Enclave believes that anyone that is not a member of the Enclave is a mutant. So even if you're not mutated, if you're not in the Enclave, you're a mutant. And they believe everyone needs to be eradicated besides Enclave members.
Yeah. So like the Brotherhood of Steel is kind of like Space Marines. The Enclave is Space Marines.
Right. Yeah. The Brotherhood of Steel has fascist tendencies. The Enclave are fascists.
Yeah. Because the Brotherhood of Steel are mixing their fascist tendency with religious tendencies.
Now, the Enclave itself was formed prior to the war as a secret cabal of the upper echelon of society. Rich industrialists, retired presidents, members of Congress, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and members of the active president's cabinet. After the bombs dropped, the Enclave rose up and executed non-Enclave politicians and bureaucrats. In the years since, they've built a xenophobic and fascist state.
Yeah, which going back earlier in this episode, we talked about the, you know, fall of the U.S. and because of the bombing and all that stuff. Technically, the way the Enclave sees it, they are the U.S. because based on order of secession, everyone who would have been in secession is dead or a member of the Enclave.
And I think also the biggest difference between the Enclave and the Brotherhood of Steel is that the Enclave really has zero regard for human life that isn't part of the Enclave, often using human experimentation to advance their technology. The Brotherhood, however, while very problematic, still holds value in non-Brotherhood members as long as they're not mutants. If you're a Wastelander who is not a mutant, the Brotherhood will respect you a bit more than they would like a ghoul. They won't respect ghouls.
I think there are some Brotherhood who could probably come to terms with mutants.
It's not part of their doctrine to hate mutants.
Right, it's not part of their doctrine.
They tend to hate mutants.
Also, Lyons is like a very important elder in the society. He's not a high elder. He becomes an elder. He's still a very important member of the Brotherhood. His influence at least is at least his chapter of the Brotherhood to really hate mutants. Now, the Enclave had hoped to capture something called Project Purity, which was a water purification system in hopes of providing themselves with such an important resource such as water. The Brotherhood engaged the Enclave and were able to take hold of Project Purity, largely thanks to having a giant robot that looked like the Iron Giant, aka Liberty Prime, who prove to be quite good at destroying members of the Enclave, mostly because it's a giant robot.
Yeah, you know how he stops them? He steps on them.
Steps on them, or uses his lasers. And this happens during the game, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So after capturing Project Purity, Elder Lyons would use it to give water to everyone in the Wasteland for free. Now, the road to hell is paved on good intentions, and while this endeavor is virtuous, it was near impossible as they had no access to bottling equipment and they had to rely on manually bottling the water themselves. These actions of the Project Purity and the capturing of the Project Purity actually happen within the Fallout video game. You interact with the Brotherhood in the Capital Wasteland in Fallout 3 and you meet Lyons at the time, who I think is Star Paladin or Elder.
He is Elder at the time, I'm pretty sure.
Out on the West Coast, the Brotherhood branch in that area was focused on a war against the expansionism of the New California Republic. Both the NCR and the Brotherhood of Steel had different ways that they believed old tech should be treated, and this disagreement would go on to become a full war between the two factions, because that's how humans are. Out in the West Coast branch, it's run by Elder Elijah, who saw significant loss when the NCR launched an attack on the Brotherhood's solar farm at Helios 1. Elder Elijah's Brotherhood retreated and would lock themselves down in a series of bunkers, which also happens during the Fallout New Vegas game.
Yeah, you don't witness the attack on Helios 1. It's already controlled by the NCR, but when you encounter the Brotherhood of Steel, they're locked into bunkers.
But you could help them take it back.
Yeah, you can.
Now, while the NCR proved successful against the Brotherhood, they would leave themselves open to attack from Kaiser and his legionnaires. And between that conflict, issues with the Las Vegas Strip, and a worthless currency, the NCR would be weakened substantially, and possibly, with a courier's help, the Brotherhood could take back Helios 1.
Yeah. To jump back to the East Coast after we've talked about the West Coast, someone who lived in the Lions branch of the Brotherhood was a young Arthur Maxon, a descendant of the Brotherhood founder Roger Maxon. Remember, we told you this name was important. Arthur Maxon witnessed the internal crumbling of Lions Brotherhood, and he took this as a sign that it was his job to do something about it. So he studied and he trained. Soon he began to have visions of leadership. At just 16, he was able to form a peace treaty with a group of Brotherhood outcasts, and with full support from his peers, he was appointed to elder, the youngest elder in Brotherhood history, because he was only 16 when he was appointed to elder.
Right, but he did have the Maxon last name.
That's right. Maxon's leadership was crucial to unifying the eastern branch of the Brotherhood. One thing that helped was the use of the Prydwen, a massive airship that allowed the Brotherhood to assert their dominance in regions that they felt needed it. So, if there's anything that tells you you're the leader, it's piloting an airship the size of a small city and carpet bombing a place. And one of those places they felt needed a little bit of extra security was the Commonwealth, due to fears of growing power of the Institute and their synths. And for the most part, this is where the history of the Brotherhood has got to the point where the farthest in the games. So there is some stuff coming out with the show right now that we aren't going to spoil, partially because Seth hasn't finished the show and I haven't finished the show. So
right. So we can't spoil it.
Yeah. We don't want to spoil it for ourselves, let alone for you.
But there is a ship that may show up in the show, and it looks a lot like the Prydwen.
It does look a lot like the Prydwen. And needless to say, though, Maxon's leadership is crucial, and it's formative. In Fallout 4, the Brotherhood is much different than it was in New Vegas. In Fallout 4, the Brotherhood is not hiding. They are obviously there. Though in my version of Fallout 4, Maxon died because I shot him. And I took his jacket because I really wanted his jacket.
It's a good jacket.
It was a good jacket.
I want to talk a little bit about the economy that this organization has, because unlike in previous in the previous lore episode where we talk about the NCR and the Kaiser's Legion, who had really unique currency within their own that they created beyond the standard of the cap, which is the currency of Fallout, the Brotherhood of Steel acts more like a military organization with some caveats. The rules are that resources are given out based on need, which includes power armor, weapons, ammunition, and even healthcare. However, if a member has not been part of the Brotherhood of Steel for more than 10 years, then they are charged a surcharge for the services, which is, I think, also a part of the in-game explanation of why you still need to pay for health restores, even if you join the Brotherhood of Steel within the game. But it is a fun fact that somebody does say, if you haven't been a member of, if you haven't been a member long enough to not get free healthcare. However, like in life, the higher the rank you are in society, the more rules you can break. And you could just pretty much give anyone anything you want from the Brotherhood Quartermaster for rewards or equipment for specialty missions if you're a high enough rank. So like if you're a high elder and you want to reward some random outsider a bunch of money and ammunition and stuff like that, you could just say, here you go, because I'm the high elder or I'm the elder. And nobody can question you because that's how life works. Everything that the Brotherhood issues is tracked by a serial number that the quartermasters maintain and create so that there's an inventory across the society, which can be quickly determined of where things are, which is interesting in itself because I think they're the only society that really tracks things within the Fallout universe. I feel like they're the ones that would also be like, we've got spreadsheets to be able to keep track of equipment, which is helpful in a world of finite resources.
Yeah, no, they're thorough.
Well, they should be.
Now that we've covered the currency of the Brotherhood, you've probably heard us using different terms throughout this episode. We've referred to elders, high elders, paladins, knights, star paladins. So let's talk about the hierarchy. The Brotherhood of Steel might look the same to an outsider no matter where they are, but there are in fact distinct hierarchies throughout the wasteland. So there are six different main ones that we're going to talk about in this episode. Though since the Brotherhood operates as cells led by elders in various parts of the wasteland, there's actually no telling how many hierarchies are out there and whether or not they are rogue. A rogue chapter is any chapter that does not recognize the authority of Lost Hills or has completely abandoned the ideology and codex of the Brotherhood.
During the early years, the Brotherhood established a split path structure that we'll be alluding to when we talk about the structure of various other models. In the earliest breakdown of how the Brotherhood was built, there were two paths, scribe and squire. Scribes are the science class, providing research, maintaining knowledge, experimenting with new technology, and understanding the past technologies. In the early model, a scribe could only advance to the rank of paladin, and from there, they could advance to the rank of elder, and finally high elder, which if you weren't Maxon, probably not. A squire, meanwhile, would be able to advance to the rank of initiate, then to knight, then to senior knight, then to paladin, then to elder and high elder. Knights can be defined differently depending on the model, but generally they are the footmen and the craftsmen of the brotherhood. A knight would be a quartermaster, would be somebody who would be a knight. Medic, maybe a scribe, could also be a knight. Part of the roles of the knights would be maintaining stockpiles of technology, repairing that technology, producing and crafting weapons, going on patrol, scouting, and supporting the paladins. Knights would often take up combat roles if there were not enough paladins to provide adequate combat, and knights would generally get power armor as well. And so really it would be in this kind of original organization, there would be like paladins that would be acting as the commanders. The knights would also, being on the beginning tier of becoming like a paladin and a star paladin, if this Star Paladin rank was available, they would also be only in power armor by exception, not necessarily by rule. The paladins are the combat force. They are the ones in power armor. And the paladins are also the only ones allowed in power armor, with some exceptions made to some knights. And also very dependent on the chapter itself.
Yes, and it's different in different models, yeah.
If the chapter is flush with power armor, I guarantee you everybody's walking around in power armor. That's why we're a little vague in regards to who's in power armor. Generally, knights could be in it. Definitely paladins are in it. And then sometimes elders are not in it, right? Because elders are like back to being like just old grouchy men. The elders make the decisions. They are the leaders who determine high-level things like a campaign strategy to even low-level minutia like what people are eating. Elders can advance to the highest position of high elder. However, once again, you have to be Maxon in order to apply.
Now, in the Lost Hills model, the lowest level is the initiates. Initiates are the youngest members of the Brotherhood who train, learn, and work to advance their status. Initiates are given a choice. After studying for some time and advancing to senior initiate, they can be promoted to either scribe or knight. From this point, they will enter their apprenticeship of either being a scribe or knight apprentice. Apprentice scribes in the Lost Hills model can be promoted to scribe, then to senior scribe, and then to head scribe. After completing their knight apprenticeship in the Lost Hills model, an apprentice knight can then advance to knight, then to senior knight, and then to head knight. Knights may also choose the path of a paladin, and as mentioned, paladins are the combat force. Paladins can advance to senior paladins and then head paladins. All three paths, scribe, knight, and paladins, can advance to the role of elder. High elders are elected by the Council of Elders, and they have the option to decline. So if the high elder is not Maxon somehow, and Maxon says, excuse me, that's my job, then the high elder can say, oh, you're right, this was a fraud election.
Also, it should be noted that the Lost Hills is the quote-unquote true model, what should be the ideal model. Now there is the Atlas model. Veterans from Lost Hills in Fort Atlas, Appalachia had structure similar to the Lost Hills. For the Atlas model, the lowest level though was Hopeful. Hopefuls are exactly what they sound like. They're not completely considered members of the Brotherhood and are seeking to be initiated. Sometimes Hopefuls will shadow initiates. Hopefuls can be sworn into the Brotherhood, and at that point they become initiates. And from here, the path of brother mirrors that of the Lost Hills, which we just discussed, but without the breakdown of senior and head positions. Another change is that knights advance to the status of paladin rather than adjacent to paladins. So it's very similar to the Lost Hills model, just a little truncated. The Atlas model is the model that you can find in Fallout 76, which takes place in Appalachia.
Now, the Lions model is the model practiced by the Brotherhood within the Citadel, a bunker in the Capital Wasteland. The model is named for Elder Owen Lyons, who acted as the Star Paladin until his death. And he was also considered an elder. So he was elder, I think, slash Star Paladin. I don't know. He was special. His daughter, Sarah Lyons, took his place when he passed. The first stage in Lion's model is squires, who are children. Squires are indoctrinated at an early age. This includes teaching the ideology of the Brotherhood and training. In Fallout 3, which is the example of the Lion's model, there is one squire, and that squire is the only child there, and that is Arthur Maxon. Once a squire gets old enough, they can advance to the state of initiate. Initiate scribes and knights all function the same as they were described before. One difference in the Lion's model is that the roles of knights and scribe are clearly defined and have a hierarchical structure. Scribes, for example, can advance to senior scribe, proctor, and finally head scribe. A knight advances to knight sergeant, knight captain, paladin, star paladin, sentinel, and lastly, elder. Another difference in the Lion's model is that power armor was used by both knights and paladins. They were a little more forgiving and they weren't as restrictive.
A knight is really like a baby paladin in this model because there really is only the two different paths where you either go, are you fighting or are you using technology? I think it's also funny that in that Lion's model, a scribe can't become an elder.
Yeah, it literally truncates off.
If you are not in the path of fighting people, you cannot be in charge of a Lion's chapter. Now, the Maxon model, this time named for Elder Arthur Maxon, part of the Maxon lineage. The Maxon model expands upon the Lion's model and was practiced by the Brotherhood of members in the areas like the Commonwealth, which is Fallout 4. An important note is that both the Maxon model and the Lion's model accept the application of non-Brotherhood Wastelanders like the player character into the fold. Similar to the Lion's model, the first step is Squire. However, from here you have three options: Scribe Initiate, Initiate, and Lancer Initiate. Scribe Initiate and Initiate follow similar structures to the Lion's model, but the Lancer path was added to acknowledge air combat. Lancers are trained to pilot vertibirds and the Pridwin, which is the flagship of the Brotherhood in the Commonwealth. After Lancer Initiate, the advancement goes to Lancer, then Lancer Knight, then Lancer Sergeant, then Lancer Captain, and then the Lancer Captain of the Pridwin, which is considered a higher position than just a standard captain. Even in the Knight model, I believe. It's higher than if you went up as a Knight and you were a Captain of the Knights. The Lancer Captain of the Pridwin is just in charge, but mostly because they're piloting the Pridwin. That's an important job.
Like, the Pridwin has vertibirds on it, so
yes, it's like an aircraft carrier in the sky. Another difference between the Maxon model and the Lion's model is that it follows the Lost Hill structure of allowing head scribes, knights, and now lancers all to become elders. I know that we have one more model to talk about, but I think that there's so much to unpack when it comes to the Brotherhood of Steel. There is, in fact, I was looking it up, I think there's like 8 or so like different chapters. Some of them are rogue chapters. Some of them are not rogue chapters. Some of them are chapters that become rogue chapters. Then they become outcast chapters. Then they come back and become regular chapters. And that's actually, how, is it Lyons' chapter actually goes rogue? And then when Maxon comes back, it comes back and becomes not rogue because it becomes their like Maxon reforms it. There's just a lot of nuances when it comes to the Brotherhood and their different hierarchies. But there's a new one that was just introduced to us, and that one Zach's gonna go over with us.
You're right, and that's what I'm calling the Amazon model. It's not officially mapped and doesn't have an official name yet, but it is the model that the Amazon show does appear to have, and it does appear to be slightly different in structure, specifically in the earliest levels and knights. So the show really has only shown one side. We haven't seen really any scribes, but from what we have seen, the path appears to be aspirant, squire, and then knight, which is a big change considering that in all the previous models, squire is always children.
Which I was thinking about that going back briefly to when we were talking about the economy and the healthcare. Being part of the Brotherhood of Steel for over 10 years is not that big of a deal if you are a child who is a squire, right? So if you're a child who's a squire who's 5, once you become 15, you are now a member of the Brotherhood of Steel for 10 years. And that means you get free healthcare.
That's true. Now, at least how the Amazon show does appear to show it, aspirants are the like earliest level. These are the people that want to be Brotherhood of Steel members. They aspire to be anointed. Squires in the show directly serve a knight. They do things like providing support during combat, carrying supplies, cleaning power armor. They are literally squires. They are the people that help the knights. They are also branded with the sigil of the knight they serve. serve, which is a mark that represents their commitment to that knight until their death or ascension. And the knights appear to be equivalent to the paladins. The knights are the power armor wielders, and they are considered kind of the force to be reckoned with. And again, this is only what we have seen from the show so far. So obviously there could be more to it that just hasn't been revealed to us, but from what we have seen so far, knights are kind of more on the same level as paladins, and squires are, could be considered more of like knights in the earlier models. They help the paladins.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I think also it's interesting that all the knights are like called like Lord, and like there's like Lord Titus and Lord.
Yeah, Lord Titus. And
I think, what is it, the guys who are yelling at them, are they elders? Or I don't
know. Yeah, they're elders, because they refer to them as elders. So those are definitely elders.
So it's like a truncated path.
We haven't seen scribes yet. I mean, the elders kind of look like they're scribes.
Yeah, the elders kind of look like scribes. Maybe the guy who's teaching them is a scribe, and the guy who's outside is the elder. I think it's cool. I think it meshes in with the world as well. I don't think they really deviated too far from the various different hierarchies.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, as we've talked about, each branch of the Brotherhood has its own different hierarchy structure, so this might just be a branch that we don't know yet. I mean, even the Western branches were divided, so.
Yeah, or an evolution of, perhaps we'll be introduced to Maxon sometimes in the future of the show, and maybe this is an evolution of his hierarchy.
And it's actually important to note that the Amazon show is the furthest in the timeline in general. It is past Fallout 4, so it is the farthest, and a lot of things change. You know, as they say, war never changes, but it does.
Do you know what doesn't change? The Pridwin.
That's right.
Maybe we'll get a Liberty Prime.
I just googled Liberty Prime, and there's a Giant Bomb article, and it just says, Liberty Prime is a giant communist-hating robot that is a symbol of freedom.
It's true.
Anyway, that will be our Brotherhood of Steel episode. I mean, without making a pun, it just scratches the armor of what the Brotherhood of Steel is. The Brotherhood of Steel is complex, it is dense, and it is deep, but we hope this helped you in navigating the world of Fallout if you are new to it, as well as learning a bit about the world of Fallout if you're not familiar with it.
And I was thinking, while talking about the Brotherhood of Steel, there's so much to unpack when it comes to Fallout. There's so much lore to it, and there's so much fun lore to just talk about. So I think maybe in a future episode, maybe not immediately, but maybe sometime soon, maybe we'll talk about the various different vaults that are in Fallout.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Plenty of stuff to talk about when it comes to Fallout, and this show being out, I think it's kind of re-sparked Zach's and my interest, at least, into it. So we'll probably do a couple more Fallout episodes, and then we'll probably wait a couple hundred episodes and then do another one.
Yeah, probably. Well, to get into our retro rewind, Seth had me play Super Off-Road, which technically is not the name of the game. Technically, the full name is Ivan Ironman Stewart's Super Off-Road, which was developed by Leland Corporation in 1989, originally for the arcade, but later ported to various systems by a variety of companies. For example, Rare did an NES port, Software Creations did a Genesis port, and the port I'm talking about today is the MS-DOS port done by Graftgold. So Seth asked me to play the MS-DOS version, and that's exactly what I did. And I was going into it with low expectations, and you know what? I had my expectations blown away. It's actually a pretty nice, fun game. I was surprised. I feel like MS-DOS games, especially ports of arcade games, can be very hit or miss in my experience. Also, especially racing games. But I had a good time. It's a very nice looking game. It's a fun game. It has some really great graphics. The sound wasn't great, because the three options were no sound, IBM sound, or ad-lib. And I chose IBM sound, and my ExoDOS was pretending to be a speaker, so it was just making buzzies. So the sound wasn't amazing. But it was still a fun game. It's still a very good looking game. It did take me a bit to get used to the controls themselves. They were a bit awkward. For example, on the keyboard, Q accelerates you. However, turning is mapped to ZXCV. So that was a little confusing. Also, to boost, you had to press the letter A, and you have to hold Q to accelerate. So you have to kind of like, you have to use like two hands in a very small cramped area. Not ideal, but doable. And once I figured it out, I felt like I was getting pretty good at it, and I felt like I had good control of the car. The game does remind me a lot of RC Pro-Am, which I love. I love RC Pro-Am, and I love Championship Pro-Am, which was for the Genesis, and I love that game. And so I think Ivan Ironman Stewart Super Off-Road does in fact hold up. Next week, Seth, you can play Clax for the NES.
Nice. Now, Zach had me play Adventures of Lola. The Adventures of Lola is a puzzle adventure game released by HAL Laboratory for the NES back for the North American market in 1989 and for the EU market in 1991. It's fun fact, it's actually the fifth game in a series of games in the Eggerland universe where you play as a blue ball named Lola, but it was only the third game released in that series in Europe and the first in North America. So the North American market just got this random game set in Eggerland, where the Japanese got a fifth game and set in the same universe. Now, I'm a fan of puzzle games, and this particular game has is set in a top-down perspective where you play as the aforementioned blue ball named Lola, and you have to traverse through various number of rooms. There's 50 in all, and you have to kind of avoid obstacles and the various different enemies throughout the levels. The game is pretty fun. It definitely has some of that late 80s, early 90s Nintendo vibes for puzzle adventure, and kind of gives you some similar vibes to Zelda games when it comes from that top-down kind of adventure style. It definitely holds up for me for today, as the gameplay and graphics still look good, and next week, Zach, you can play Star Wars Episode 1 Racer for the N64.
Will do. With that, I want to thank everyone for listening to our episode. If you have any questions or thoughts about the Brotherhood of Steel, you can email us at classicgamingbrothers@gmail.com. We're also available on Facebook, Classic Gaming Brothers, Instagram, Classic Gaming Brothers, X, CG Brothers Pod, Blue Sky CG Brothers Pod, and we're available on Threads, Classic Gaming Brothers. We're available wherever podcasts can be found, be it iHeartRadio, Podbean, or YouTube. And with that, Seth, am I forgetting anything?
Don't play games like my brother.
And don't play games like my brother.
I've been Seth.
And I've been Zach.
And we've been the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right.